Support for the Projection Booth podcast comes from Stitcher Smart Radio. Now podcast listeners can access the latest episodes of the Projection Booth and thousands of other podcasts on the go without downloading or syncing. Stitcher instantly delivers episodes of your favorite shows to your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio can be found in the iPhone and Android app stores or on the web at stitcher.com/booth.
This is the story of the last starfighter. You can read along with me in your book. You will know it is time to turn the page when you hear the chimes ring like this. Let's begin now.
Greetings, starfighter. You have been recruited by the Star League to defend the frontier against Zur and the Kodan Armada.
The Starfighter video game bleeped and boomed as Alex Rogan skillfully destroyed the Kodan fighters one by one. This was the only bright spot in Alex's dreary life at a dull trailer park. When he held the Starfighter controls, his creative imagination soared.
Come on, Alex! They're here!
Alex Rogan had a dream.
You really are leaving here, aren't you?
To be as far away from here as possible.
You get your chance. When it comes, you gotta grab it with both hands.
It started with a game.
You're gonna bust the record.
But it wasn't just any game.
You have been recruited by the Star League to defend the frontier against Zur and the Kodan Armada.
And then, one night...
Centauri's the name. We have to talk about a matter of utmost importance. Step into my office. I've seen him come and I've seen him go, but you're the best, my boy. Light years ahead of the competition. Hey.
Alex didn't find his dream.
Hey, look out!
Oh, dear. Hey.
His dream found him.
Welcome to Rylos, my boy.
A world on the brink of destruction.
You were recruited by the Star League to defend
the frontier against Zur and the Kodan Armada.
Of all the life forms, on all the planets, in all the galaxies...
Oh my God!
Has been chosen. Alex Rogan.
Alex?
Hey, Max.
Is the last starfighter. For every Earthling who's ever imagined traveling beyond the stars.
Maybe there is a starfighter left.
I love you, Alex Rogan.
The unforgettable story of one who made it. The last starfighter.
Welcome to the Projection Booth. I'm your host, Mike White. Rob St. Mary is away this week. He's fighting crime in the city of Gotham. Joining me instead is Mr. Chris from the Outside the Cinemas podcast. It's good to have you here, sir.
Thank you. It's very, very good to be here, finally.
This week, we're looking at the 1984 sci-fi flick, The Last Starfighter, directed by Nick Castle and written by Jonathan Bichel. The story tells the story of Alex Rogan, a young man on the cusp of adulthood who wants to leave his life at the Starlight Starbright trailer park. He's the handyman of the park, and its wacky inhabitants keep him busy. His only refuge is a video game. We're talking about one of those old console machines. But just when things look bleakest for him, he's pretty much shanghaied by Centauri, the slick-talking inventor of the game. Centauri reveals that the details of the video game are real, and that Alex's impressive performance has made him eligible to be part of the Star League and to defeat the forces of Zur and the Kodan Armada. That's pretty much just the first act of the film, which was groundbreaking in its use of computer-generated effects. So, Mr. Chris, what's your history with The Last Starfighter?
Having grown up in the 80s, this was pretty much a staple of cable. So my history with it would be, I guess, watching it every Saturday forever.
Did you see it in the theater?
I've spent a long time trying to remember if I did, and I don't remember.
Yeah, I can't remember either if I saw it there or not. But yeah, it seems like VHS or cable screenings. But this one's kind of indelibly pressed into my brain.
It's definitely something that I should have seen in the theater, but I don't want to lie and say, oh yeah, I have, and then not be sure.
I won't ask for ticket stubs. Don't worry about it.
You know, if I had seen it, I probably would still have them.
What were your impressions of the film? I mean, does it hold up? For me, it still does. I don't know if it's just kind of seeing it through the lens of nostalgia or whatever, but I still dig it.
When you invited me onto the show, I don't do this often. I went out and I bought the Blu-ray, and I think I watched it 4 times total before today. And I only really needed to watch it once, but I enjoy it so much, I watched it those other times because it really is just a lot of fun. And it actually does hold up if you can get past the there's still arcade machines around, which, you know, I see them every now and then. You know, the odd pizza place here and there will have one. And so it's not totally out of left field, I guess.
Yeah, it would make sense. I bet you if you go to the Starlight Starbright trailer park right now, might be a couple console games hanging out. I don't know. It doesn't seem like it's really a hip happening place.
No, definitely not.
I really like that our hero is kind of, like I said, he was shanghaied by Centauri, who's played by Robert Preston, who is just awesome in this role. I love him and hearing his whole patter and everything. I mean, they basically rewrote the character once they got the idea of, you know, the music man in space kind of thing. I like, though, that he gets up to the planet and is just like, yeah, not for me. Just take me home.
It was the whole victory or death thing that just kind of changed his mind. He's like, yeah, this is pretty neat. All right, giant spaceships, just like I've seen. Wait, I have to die? That was a very realistic response. The big difference with Alex, I think, from the beginning is, we should just get this out of the way in the beginning, I guess. This is Star Wars with Earth, more or less. And Alex is the Luke character, and it really does follow through the whole Joseph Campbell mythos with the mentor dying and all that. Sorry if I'm spoiling anything for anybody. The big difference between Luke and Alex is Alex isn't whiny. You're not put off by him. He cares about everybody around him, and he wants to help everybody, which is kind of different from how you're introduced to Luke's selfish behavior.
Yeah, Alex really wants to get out of town. It kind of reminded me, speaking of another George Lucas film, it reminded me a little bit of, I think it was Kurt, the Richard Dreyfuss character in American Graffiti, where it was like, you know, I'm leaving town, I have to get out of here, and he was just so determined to leave and everything. And that's really what I was getting from Alex.
He didn't go about it in a mean way. He just, not that Richard Dreyfuss's character did either, but I mean, the big joke is Luke whining about, you know, wanting to do what he wants to do. And
take these two over to the garage, will you? I want them cleaned up before dinner.
But I was going into Tosche Station to pick up some power converters.
You can waste time with your friends when your chores are done. Now, come on, get to it.
Alex doesn't do that. He's like, all right, I'm a responsible person. I guess I'll go do that.
Mr. Serioso.
Yeah?
Honey, Elvira's electric is out.
Oh, my, that's going to take all day. I was going to Silver Lake.
Honey, I know. I'm sorry. I'm working lunch and dinner. I'm going to be in town all day.
Oh, all right. Okay, Ma. I'll do it.
Thanks, honey.
And it's when escape is the game. And I thought the way they built that was really brilliant.
Yeah, and I love that whole idea, that whole Excalibur scenario where it's like, you know, they're looking for somebody who's going to be awesome at this because it's basically training them to be this incredible fighter and to join the Star League and everything. It's that bit of cleverness, I just think, it gives it more gravity than normally. You know, it could be a cheesy sci-fi film, but instead, you know, it's got that really great core idea in there that just kind of puts it over the edge for me.
Yeah, and as I watched it, the first rewatch I did with the recent watches, I thought there's like 3 reasons that this thing is elevated above your B-grade, you know, sci-fi ripoff in the 80s, and the graphics, the use of the computer graphics was one, but just the heart that was put into it, it didn't seem like just a shallow cash grab on the genre.
the other smart thing, I think, was the whole idea of having that beta Alex, the copy of Alex that stays behind on Earth. And so you get that kind of fish out of water story going on at the same time. Will people find out or won't they? And it's almost like this like mini version of Starman going on inside of this other film.
Yeah, yeah. And then at the end, the reveal is so much more powerful for everybody in the trailer park because they thought he was there the whole time. The last time I watched it, there was one thing that really kind of, I don't know if it was a character thing or not, but it, again, it's at the very end when Maggie shakes hands with Greg and then he squats down to talk to Alex's brother. You see her in the background wiping her hand on her shirt and looking at it like, what did I just do?
Oh, that's not very nice.
No, I thought that was, well, it's kind of in character for her because she's never seen anybody like that before. Never met an alien. But it was weird that they framed it and it's like dead center in the shot.
You know, I've never picked up on that, no matter how many times I've seen it.
It was just the last thing I noticed when I watched it again yesterday. Maybe it speaks a little to, I don't know, xenophobia or I don't know, because there was a lot of stuff going on in the 80s with Cold Wars and people being different than everybody else. And but I can't imagine they would do one throwaway shot like that. And maybe it was just a decision she made on the spot. I don't know.
Yeah, because they do think he's a monster at first. But, yeah. You know, once they start speaking English and everything.
Yeah, that was a little strange because nobody else had the translator thing on their collars. But
I'm glad I'm not the only one that picked that up.
Yeah.
I was like, boy, he knows English really good.
Yeah, he really did.
And not a hint of accent.
The thing about him meeting all the humans at the end, he has a line that I use to this day, and it amuses me to no end, and no one gets it. When somebody asks, how do you do?
I do well.
I thought that was a brilliantly funny line.
So we got Beta Alex on Earth. We've got Alex coming back, so we've got that great scene with the two Alexes talking to each other. And I have to say, Lance Guest does a really good job of acting against himself.
He does. He has really good comic timing, too.
I don't know if it was just the editing or how they were doing that, but that scene was very, very tight the way they did that. And I was very surprised that Lewis, his younger brother, is not a complete pain in the ass, because his character could have really turned very quickly. And there were a couple times where I'm just like, but
yeah.
he's not too annoying.
No, they used him very sparingly and they gave him some pretty funny lines.
You know, the other thing I really like is this whole idea of the rebel son and the way that the Kodans are just kind of really barely tolerating Xur and just what a douche he is.
I don't know what it is about him, but you look at him and you instantly are revulsed by him. Well, not with the hologram shot of his head so much, but when he's in person, there's just something like he's not big enough, like physically, to be in that role. He's like this slimy, he's like Grima Wormtongue from Lord of the Rings. That's kind of how he strikes me, like this mewling little petulant child. And they never explore how he got to where he was.
Yeah, it's kind of nice that they don't a little, because it's like, you know that he betrayed his father and that he was, you know, selling secrets and stuff. But yeah, that whole thing where it's like, because he's got his little lackey guy there too. And I've always wanted to know more about his lackey, the guy that brings him his scepter and stuff.
Maybe it's the time that it came out, but that little dude reminded me of the podlings from the Dark Crystal. the slave ones to the Skeksis. I don't know. Maybe because one of them carries the other guy's scepter in the other movie. I don't know. But it's like that kind of slave situation, I figured.
Well, I have to say the Krill, I don't know why, but they always reminded me of the one alien race in Battle Beyond the Stars. The guy who is very lizard-like, very Bosk-like, and you know, kind of wants to die a glorious death.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I know that one came out, 4 or 5 years before this one. So, but something about those. I think the character and the makeup effects, again, really top notch.
Oh, absolutely. That was another thing that just elevates it from thrown together just to make a dollar.
Yeah, even that little quick shot of Centauri when he removes his face and he's polishing his eyes and stuff and he turns around and he's got those glowing eyes and that, you know, bizarre face.
Yeah.
I mean, it's such a throwaway scene. They could have completely done without that, but it's great.
You know,
just nice little touches like that.
Listening to the commentary somebody that I don't think gets nearly enough credit for the stuff they've done. Ron Cobb did all of the work on this, all the concept design. And there's a guy that I don't think, I mean, you see Harryhausen gets a lot of, you know, artistic credit for what he does. And Ralph McQuarrie gets tons of love thrown, all for good reason. But like, Ron Cobb's designed some pretty impressive stuff. And nobody knows who he is. I like him a lot, and he can create stuff that just looks like it all fits together.
Yeah, his stuff is terrific, and yeah, he's not one of those names that gets bandied about.
No, and that's a shame.
Maybe we can do a Ron Cobb series or something.
That would be some fantastic movies too.
You know, I have to say Nick Castle did a really good job directing this as well. He had only done one movie before this, the Tag, the Assassination Game, which was a lot of fun.
In the commentary, he talks about Tag a lot and how he met a bunch of people that he brought into Last Starfighter, but I haven't seen it, so I have no knowledge.
It was one of those cable movies that I used to see quite often. And I remember when I was in college, I think like first or second year, we were playing some sort of like, you know, campus-wide assassination game that was very similar to this. So, but I don't remember it too well because for some reason I keep thinking that it was the guy that played Goose was the main character, but I know that's not right. I think I'm mixing it up with Gotcha.
Oh, yeah, I remember that one. Robert Carradine and Linda Hamilton.
Good memory.
No, that's not memory.
Oh, okay. Good IMDb skills.
I'm not going to take credit for that. I can't say I've never seen that movie and then name people that were in it.
Okay, well, I thought maybe you might remember the poster or the video box. I mean, there are so many movies where it's like, yeah, I've never seen it, but I remember exactly what the video box looked like.
Oh, yeah, totally.
No, I've never seen Phenomenon, but I sure remember those bugs crawling all over Jennifer Connelly. Castle and Carpenter really worked a lot together when they were first, starting out. And I don't know what happened to that relationship, if it soured somehow or if they just, you know, if it was a natural, you know, progression on both of their parts. But they did some great stuff together. I mean, Castle was the Shape in Halloween, and I think he helped write Escape from New York. So he was doing some good stuff. And,
yeah. You
know, I don't really know. I mean, I can't say like, oh, well, you know, the last few films of his were awful because frankly, I haven't seen them. I think the last movie I saw of his was Major Pain. Yeah. And I kind of skipped Dennis the Menace and I didn't see Mr. Wrong just because by that time I kind of knew Ellen DeGeneres was Lebanese and the whole idea of her trying to find Mr. Right. I was just like, yeah, I just don't buy it at all. So
I think that sunk the whole movie.
Kind of like Rosie O'Donnell's crush on Tom Cruise. It's like, what? All right, we're going to take a break and play a couple of messages and then play back some interviews that I did with Starz Lance Guest and Catherine Mary Stewart.
Everyone wants to spice things up in the bedroom. Here's an offer you won't want to miss. Listeners of the Projection Booth podcast can enjoy 50% off just about any one item at adamandeve.com when you use the promotion code BOOTH. You also get free shipping and 3 free adult DVDs. Once again, that promotional code is BOOTH. That's B-O-O-T-H. Visit adamandeve.com today.
This is Jamie from Devour the Podcast. Do you enjoy horror commentary with straightforward honesty?
Oh my God, this movie. This movie's so hard.
Oh my goodness. You know, halfway through this movie, I was just like, let's get this thing going.
This movie. Humor and an obvious passion for the genre.
Pick up this baby. I'll kick him in the face.
I like the cut of your jib. The ceiling, Grandma. Don't make me get out the broom. Oh, your tears are like wine. They used to call that the vapors. Cupcakes are kind of the Schindler's List of desserts. It's a pure good. I love the idea of up-and-coming horror directors taking on the found footage genre. I really, really like that idea.
And that's really the worst thing you can commit as far as filmmaking is concerned, is making a film that's just average.
Well, that doesn't really inspire any kind of discussion, whether it's, you know, know, to rip it apart or praise it, then you should spend time with David and me.
And Bo.
As we discuss horror films from old classics.
Deep Red. Empire of the Ants. Lisa and the Devil. The Baby. The Toxic Avenger.
To new favorites.
Absentia. Cabin in the Woods. The Loved Ones. Shadow of Death. VHS. The Woman.
Check us out on iTunes or at devourthepodcast.blogspot.com. Devour the Podcast is a proud member of the Horrorphilia Podcasting Network.
You like midnight movies, don't you? But can you handle midnight movies 24 hours a day?
Your death will be indescribable.
Find out on Black Flag TV. The first viral television on the web. Black Flag TV is entirely dedicated to haunting horror, science fiction, and cult movies. Broadcasting live, 24 hours a day, obscure independent movies and classic horror. Make Black Flag TV your sanctuary for the horror genre.
They're coming to get you, Barbara.
Visit us now, blackflag.tv.
So how sick are you of talking about The Last Starfighter?
No, I'm not sick at all. I've been playing Johnny Cash for 4 years straight. I've been doing that forever. So I just got off of that. We just closed a couple days ago.
Yeah, I was just watching the David Letterman clip of you guys. It was amazing. It was hard for me to reconcile that was you.
Oh, good. Well, that's why we act, I guess. Try to convince people we're somebody else.
So how'd you do it? How'd you get the low voice going for that one?
It's not that hard, really. For me, it's just that's kind of where my voice usually is. I just don't exaggerate it that much because it's a little over the top. I mean, anybody that would, you know, that would just talk like this all the time would just kind of be, I don't know, sort of makes us putting something on. I think all the guys in my family have pretty low voices. So you get really close to the mic, you can get a lot more volume and a lot more sort of clarity. That's what like disc jockeys and radio guys do. They don't really sound that cool. They just get right up on the mic.
So you've been playing guitar since you were 11. When did you get into acting?
High school? I guess I was acting in high school. You know, I was just like nonstop plays, you know. You know, some people play on the football team. Some people, you know, like I had a friend played in rock bands. And, you know, some people do sports. And I did plays. You know, there was a fairly thriving drama program by the time I got to school. And people were pretty serious about it. Everybody was, you know, like we had sort of professional, I would say professional caliber teachers teaching us. Like in the summertime, we'd go to, it wasn't really summer camp, but it was like this place that we would go and we'd learn all, you know, we'd do Shakespeare and all that stuff. We'd learn kind of a lot of stuff that I, you know, that I kind of already, I mean, by the time I got to college, I was a theater major in college, and a lot of the stuff I knew in college, a lot of stuff I learned in college, I'd already learned sophomore year in high school, you know.
So how'd you make the leap from playing guitar kind of off the beaten path into jumping into Halloween 2?
Jumping into Halloween 2. Yeah, I mean, it was at the time it was still a low-budget independent movie, and it was a follow-up to Halloween, and Halloween's a big deal, but it was still an independent. It was called an independent. The independent production company was Pumpkin Productions, but it was a Universal movie. But I had been doing like TV auditions and film auditions since November of the previous year. And I guess I got my first job in January on a TV show on Lou Grant. And then I got a bunch of other TV gigs. And I got maybe one or two more. And then I auditioned for this, I think, in February. I think it was. And then we started filming in April, I think. So it was just another audition, you know. It wasn't like I see this Halloween 2 casting, I'm going to go up for it. It was just my agent sent me out and said, hey, you know, they're doing another Halloween movie, show up here. And I was telling the guy, it was like an 8:30 a.m. audition. I was driving all the way out from like West LA to like Burbank or Glendale or something, little place. It was kind of an odd audition time. And because I remember there was snow all over the place, it was weird for LA. And hey, it was just kind of, so when I first met Jamie, I just walked in the door and Jamie was like, hi, how you doing? You know, she's real friendly and real outgoing and everything, and we read our scene, and then that was it. You know, I got the job.
So I know there was a connection with Nick Castle in the first Halloween. Was there any kind of connection with the second Halloween? Had you met him before Last Starfighter?
No, what happened was that Nick, you know, Nick's friends with John, and Nick was working on the first Halloween, and then when the second Halloween was being made, Nick was actually prepping Last Starfighter. You know, they were getting that nailed down and working on the script, and he had seen, you know, he sort of went, as he tells it, he was visiting John in the editing room, and they were, you know, looking at through the old moviolas, and he was, you know, cutting the film, and I think John did a lot of the cutting on the film, a lot of the editing, and he was like, "Who's that guy?" You know, and John's like, "Oh yeah, this is, you know, White Scarlet in the movie," and that's when Nick sort of got the idea to maybe, you know, I would be possible for his new movie, you know, his new thing. So I was sort of put on the list, and then they called me in, and I auditioned, and they liked me enough and cast. You know, I read with a, you know, there was a bunch of, you make final callbacks. It was originally called Centauri's Recruit. That was the original title of the movie. It wasn't called The Last Starfighter until way, way, way later. But that was like a whole year later, I think, after the Halloween 2.
Yeah, it seemed like there was a little bit of a stretch of time, because you did another movie in between there, right? The Neil Simon one?
I think I did another one, too. I think I did that, and I did this movie that eventually was called Just the Way You Are. But yeah, the Neil Simon was, it was just two scenes, you know. It was just like the guy, you know, the California horny guy, you know, hitting on the lead girl and, you know, trying to take her shirt off in the back of the car. And it was like, "Hi, I'm Lance. I'm going to take your shirt off." It's like, I meet her the first day. "Hi, Donna." Dinah. I came with Dinah. Next thing you know, it's like, "Okay, roll." And we did that scene like 40 times. It was pretty fun. It's just like you barely know this person and you're like taking her shirt off.
Well, too bad it wasn't Anne Margaret, though, right?
Yeah. Yes. I met her. I got to meet Anne Margaret.
That's awesome. Yeah, that's quite an amazing cast with her and Walter Matthau. I mean,
yeah.
But I have to say the cast for Last Starfighter was pretty great, too. I mean, Robert Preston and Dan O'Herlihy. I mean, those guys must have been just terrific to work with. At least that's my impression of them. You can tell me the real dirt.
There isn't really any dirt other than, I mean, these guys are also not, they're not really known for their, you know, that was an odd sort of film. It was an odd genre. It was, you know, the genre of film was not quite established. It became much more popular and much more developed, but that kind of space comedy, fantasy, slash sci-fi sort of hybrid that it was not really, they didn't do too many of those, you know, before that. So to see these guys, these, what I would call, you know, classical actors doing this was sort of fun because it wasn't, you know, it didn't go with the rest of the thing. Although Preston's character was very similar to the Music Man, you know, the sort of hustler, con man guy, but you know, Dan was, you know, did Macbeth, and he did, you know, Robinson Crusoe, and he did all this stuff. It's all just acting, you know, it's all, I just remember Preston, I always say this about Preston, that he was such a tough guy, and he was getting up there, but he would rehearse a lot. He always wouldn't mind if ever I wanted to, like, go through it, and, you know, I was sort of obsessive, I would go through it a million times, and he was always up for it. He never, like, said, "Come on, just let it go, kid." He always would do it for me. He's a theater actor. I was always impressed by that.
This must have been quite a gig for you. I mean, you were in, there are very few scenes where you're not in it.
Yeah, it was a lot of work. I mean, it was a lot of, you know, I was pretty much in every frame. There's a couple of things that they shot, but a lot of them, it would be like, I think I only had like 3 days off, and those were the days that they were shooting the Kodan ship. And that I think they took 3 days to shoot that. But like the days that they did scenes that I was not in, I was always there. I was always at work. So I never really got a lot of, pretty much shot, I think we shot 38 days, and I was there for 35 of them. It was a pretty short schedule.
I have to admit, I didn't even realize it was Dan O'Herlihy for a lot of years. I mean, my first exposure to him was RoboCop, and then it was only, you know, I had seen Last Starfighter, and it took me years to make that connection.
Oh, really? I used to joke that, you know, I didn't recognize him when he had his mask off. Who's that guy? He had a good time, though. He really liked every little thing that he created. He really got a kick out of it. He had a really good time.
Yeah, it must have been kind of strange with him and Robert Preston being, I won't say really old, but they were quite a few years older than you. I mean, you were what, 23, 24?
I was 23 when I shot it. Actually, not even. I was almost 23. And, you know, I think they were in their 70s.
How was the atmosphere on the set?
Well, it was quick, you know. I mean, it was friendly, but it was quick because, you know, it was not a high-budget movie as far as the photography, the principal photography was concerned, because they were using this brand-new computer-generated images that hadn't been really invented yet or really effectively sort of timed or budgeted into a filming process. So they didn't really know exactly how long things would take. They didn't know what they would be able to get. And, they were depending on this thing that came out of this computer.
that most people weren't familiar with. You know, the guys that did it were familiar with it, but it was still, you know, quite early on in that. So a lot of the original, you know, programs and a lot of the original processes were just kind of developed on the fly to do that movie. And then, you know, I don't know that world that well, but I imagine a lot of them still use those same templates and formats, the things that they had to do because they had to get it done. They had to find some way to do it. You know, it was very expensive and it was very slow and it was very time consuming. And, they couldn't spend a lot of time shooting because they didn't know how long it would take for the digital stuff. And they didn't know what they were going to get. And sometimes they didn't get what they wanted to get. And sometimes they got more than what they wanted to get. But I think it took a lot longer than they expected. And the guys just totally believed in it. You know, they really were, you know, it was like kind of like the Pixar guys. That, you know, it was like this brand new technology that you just have to kind of believe in. And then they eventually paid off. Wow, this is taking a long, you know, this is expensive and taking a long time. And, you know, nobody knows anything about it. And they just kind of had to. I know Gary Adelson, one of the producers, he was one of the ones that sort of had to put his head down and go, let's just go, you know, let's just take the chance, see how it works, because they didn't know. They could have just sunk themselves and, you know, lost a bunch of money and not had anything, you know. And I know what it's like to do a movie where the effects kill the movie. I've done a few where they count on the effects and the effects are terrible and it makes the movie suck. But hopefully with Last Starfighter, that's not what happened.
I so want to guess at which movie that might be, but...
It is unfortunate, you know, they're like, you know, you pin everything on one final effect and it took forever to get that, and what they got was just not the greatest thing in the world.
But yeah, I think the effects in Last Starfighter still hold up. I mean, it's an interesting time capsule to look back at it as one of the first CGI films.
Yeah, it's kind of like that movie where, you know, that movie they have in Trip to the Moon or something where they have this outlandish special effect thing, you know, the rocket crashes into the moon, and it's like obviously really, really fake, but sort of stylized, and, you know, that was the technology at that time. And the Last Starfighter looks a little cartoony, but for its time, I think it was really sophisticated, and really, it kind of did the trick. They could do so much more than they could with models.
Yeah, I hate to use the word quaint, but it feels a little quaint, and it fits with the story.
Yeah.
I like that, you know, it's kind of taking that video game world and kind of exploding it out.
Well, it is funny because obviously that goes through everybody's mind, every little kid's mind, you know, like, well, what if this was real, you know? Like my own kid watches, you know, he watches movies and he wants the things that they do in movies to be real. He wants them to, you know, he wants there to be time machines and he wants there to be things where you can go, and, you know, back in time in the future. And that's sort of the obvious deal. If you're that young and you're playing this, like, warrior game on this thing, you kind of want to think, well, what if this was real? And it's just amazing nobody thought of it before. Yeah, there's certainly a kind of Arthurian aspect to Last Starfighter that was intentional, somewhat intentional from the writer's standpoint, which was, you know, like the sword and the stone, and the video was like the sword and the stone, and, you know, all the work that you do prior to that is in somehow preparation for your sort of your final challenge and your final quest. And, you know, obviously that's a very archetypal story. It's a real sort of common myth, the Arthurian myth, and you can sort of take a whole lot of things from it, and it's like a source material where you can take a lot of other stories from it, but that's kind of the main idea, and it's somewhat embedded in us, so that I think without getting too spacey about it, I just think it's a lot of stories can spring out of that sort of basic myth.
I wanted to ask you how it was working with Catherine Mary Stewart.
Oh, fantastic. Because I didn't really know her, you know, at all, and I think I auditioned with her in the office, and she just is, you know, she's such a lovely person, and she just made it so much fun, and you know, we get along. I mean, I see her today, you know, I see her like these days still. She's not one of those actresses she's not like a big ego actress, you know. She's not one of those people that has to be, you know. I've worked with a lot of actresses that, you know, have to be the big cheese, and she's not like that at all. I mean, she's very secure in herself, lovely, as you know, and just, yeah, really, really swell, and really kind of, I think, appropriate for what the sort of the wholesome kind of, in a real way, sort of wholesome kind of image they were going for.
Yeah, definitely that girl next door trailer next door.
Girl next trailer.
Right.
What was interesting is that the trailer part that we used, they actually I wouldn't say evicted, but they actually, you know, supplanted some of the actual residents so that we could use the trailer park for, you know, 2 weeks. And I think they put everybody up in, you know, hotels or something like that, and we used their trailer park. The real trailer park residents were very different than the, you know, Hollywood extra trailer park residents that we brought in. You know, people with no teeth and, you know, barefoot and greasy t-shirts and their bomber jackets in there, you know. But they were fascinated with it. They just kind of looked at us like, wow, man, you're making a movie.
Yeah, where was it actually shot? Like, what was the location?
I don't know the exact location. It was near Agua Dulce, and this was a long time ago. But it was up near Agua Dulce, Canyon Country, up to 14. I don't know if you're familiar with L.A. at all.
Not really, but I can always Google map it.
There were the mountains basically between Valley, the San Fernando Valley, and the Antelope Valley, you know, where Palmdale and Lancaster and that part of L.A. was. It was Air Force Base. There are mountains between San Fernando Valley and that. Yeah, not too many people know about it, but it's, you know, basically a rural mountainous kind of area. The desert is more rural. The desert is more like farmland and ranchland, and the mountains are just, you know, mountains. They're just not, they don't use a brain. There's some places that are kind of, they've been like mined, and they've, you know, leveled it out and flattened it out because it's kind of in the middle of nowhere, so they don't mind making it look terrible because nobody's going to see it. You know, they kind of quit mine and they, you know, I don't know what they do. They pull rock out of it. I don't know. But it was kind of a cool kind of place, really. I mean, it was a real scenic thing. It was right by a creek. And, you know, Kathy and I used to, you know, skipping stones or whatever, you know, doing all the regular old things that small town people do. But we, you know, we used to go down there. And it really had the kind of spirit that it portrayed. You know, the actual filming of it had the kind of spirit that comes across. You know, on set was very much like that. And the director, Nick, tried to keep it a little, you know, he tried to make it a little, I wanted to make it like super realistic. And he was like, no, it's a little broader. The comedy is broad. You gotta be bigger. Think Three Stooges, you know? And I was always like, sort of resisting that and everything because I wanted to be really serious. You know, you'd certainly need, a movie is sort of tongue in cheek. It has a lot of goofy stuff in it.
Yeah, you always seemed a little, at least the Alex Rogan, not necessarily the beta, but seemed a little, I don't know, neurotic, just like, I want to get out of here.
I just thought that it's more realistic to be fearful than to be like, I'm a movie hero, you know, I'm going to kick some ass, you know. That doesn't happen. It's just like, nobody's going to be that way. That's not going to happen in real life. People are going to be terrified in real life, and they're going to be really sort of insecure about the situation. It makes it more real, you know, makes it more identifiable rather than, because movie heroes are pretty easy things to do. Everybody wants to be brave and strong and courageous when there's, you know, no consequences. More effective to be scared to death.
I like that when you get put in those situations that your reaction is much more realistic and you are definitely much more identifiable in that way.
It's more fun too, you know, it's just more fun to do. Although the beta is more scared of them all. The beta is the most scared of all. That's the thing, he's completely out of his element. He's a total nerd. I mean, the beta is a complete geek. So he's like not even, and that what's funny is that he's only in very average situations. Kind of calms down when he has to be, you know, chasing after the guy and running the truck into the rocket ship. But when he's just trying to be, you know, fit in with the humans, he's terrified. So that was the roughest part of his role, was, you know, just being a normal person.
Have you ever seen the Last Starfighter musical?
Oddly enough, I know that it played here off Broadway, but I never saw it. I sort of, someone told me to look it up on the computer, and so I did. But when we were doing the first workshop of Million Dollar Quartet, we did it at a new musical festival where you develop new musicals for a week, and then you perform every night. They perform a different one. There were four or five musicals, and it was us, Field of Dreams, the musical, Little Women, the musical, something else, and Last Starfighter, the musical. And I walked in there like, are you kidding me? Of all these comical coincidences. And so then I went to the performance of their thing. And it really was, basically a reading where they would play all the music on piano. And they had some other kind of instruments. And so I mean, maybe it was just piano. And they would literally go through all the songs and they would read it, but they would also sing all the songs. And that's how you develop a musical. You develop the songs first and then you make sure that the book part of it, you know, sort of fits in. And but it's not, people have the scripts in their hands and it's not, you know, there's no costumes or anything. But it is, you know, it is a great deal of work. And ours, you know, we did that as well with Million Dollar Quartet. But I did go to the performance of that. It was really surreal, you know. It was very funny because it was like me trying to be Johnny Cash and then some other kid trying to be me. And, you know,
It was kind of surreal. And John came, John Betchel, the writer, he came to see the musical, and I ran into him there, and it was kind of cool to see him. And Nick had always said, you know, I'm sure you've seen it, it's been said so much of times, Nick always said that he thought that Starfighter sort of felt like a musical anyway. The movie itself sort of had this sort of sense of wonder, so he said it always sort of felt like it should be a musical. I mean, he didn't, you know, write any music to it, but he thought, you know, thought it reminded him of a musical. So it's funny that they made a musical out of it. I'm not necessarily a musical fan. I'm not like a musicals fan because I think a lot of them sound the same. You really have to do something original with the formula because it's all structure and formula. Most musicals have the exact same story. It's just you sort of plug in different people and situations, but the arc of each character goes in the same direction. And what is done so well, where it is done so well is in the book, this musical in New York, The Book of Mormon, which is sort of a stock musical structure, but it's just fantastic. You expect it to be so groundbreaking, and it is groundbreaking, but as far as the musical form, it's exactly what the musical form is. It's exactly, you could see a classic musical. Whereas, like, our play is not a classic musical at all. Our play has no allegiance to any of that stuff. It's a weird hybrid of a rock and roll show and a jam and a you know, sort of realistic kind of documentary kind of feel, and then it's also, you know, Showtime.
Actually, I wanted to jump to The Last Starfighter, if you're all right. I didn't realize until the other day that was a musical at one point. Somebody made a musical version of that one.
Yes, they did. I only found that out a couple of years ago myself. And recently on Facebook, somebody sent me a bunch of photos from it, which cracks me up as well. I'm so mad that I didn't know. I was living in New York when it was playing off Broadway, and I didn't even know it. I know. I'm so mad because I would have loved to have seen that. Again, it's like this little, to me, it's like a kind of a love letter to a movie that I was in. I just love it.
What was it like with The Last Starfighter? Because I was a big fan of that movie when I was a kid because just the special effects and kind of this, you know, every boy's fantasy of, you know, the video game that you're playing actually meaning something, I suppose. But what was that one like, and how did you get that role?
That was my first movie experience in L.A., and probably my best experience ever. Nick Castle, the director, again, this was, you know, he had a passion behind this as well, and he was such a benevolent, he loves actors, and he loved young actors, and he's kind of like a kid himself, and he just made the experience a joy. I mean, most of my stuff was shot at night, so, you know, the shooting schedule means you start shooting as soon as the sun disappears, and you stop as soon as it rises. So the schedule's grueling. It's brutal. But I was also on Days of Our Lives at that time as well, so I was doing both. I couldn't wait to go to work every day. And Lance Guest, we're still friends. He lives here in New York, and I've been in touch with him. I just did this play like I was talking about before. One of the guys who worked on the set, moving sets around and things like that on the stage, is a huge Last Starfighter fan. And he didn't realize at first that I was Mags from Last Starfighter. And when he found out, he just was beside himself, and he brought me the Blu-ray copy. And Lance, I asked Lance if he would sign a photograph for this guy for when we wrapped. And he did, and the guy was almost in tears. It was so sweet. He was so excited. And in fact, they've been talking about doing a sequel for some time as well. And a few years ago, for the 25th anniversary screening of The Last Starfighter, I was in L.A. at that time, and Lance and Nick and I got together, and Nick was sort of giving us a play-by-play of what his idea for the sequel would be and all that stuff. And I would just love it if something like that happened. It would involve Lance and I as parents of perhaps the next Last Starfighter.
Go back and rename the old one the Second to Last Starfighter. Well, that must have been a weird movie, because it's almost like two movies in one, where you're like pretty much the star of one movie, and then there's this other movie going on with Dan O'Herlihy, right, in the other movie. And
Robert Preston.
Right. So did you have very much exposure to those guys at all, or what, were you just, you know, in your own, for lack of a better term, little world, you know, back on Earth, kind of doing your own film over there?
Well, we were sort of in our own. It was very separate. In fact, the only reason I met Robert Preston was because I had to do a reshoot at a stage in Los Angeles. And they were shooting, I don't know if it was a reshoot or if, they did a lot of stuff on stage for, like, when he goes to the planet and all that other junk. I think they may have still been shooting that stuff, but Robert Preston happened to be there when I showed up to do my little pickup scene. And I got to meet him, and I was so happy that I got to meet him, because he was really one of those people that just glowed stardom. You know what I mean? He really had this aura around him. And when he met me, he kissed my hand, and he was just everything that you would expect Robert Preston to be. He was exactly like his character, you know, his characters that he's played, just sort of this benevolent kind of funny guy. So that was really cool. Dan O'Herlihy, there is a scene where at the end when he shows back up on Earth, and I end up going up with him into the, you know, he shows up on Earth with Grig. And so I did get to meet him because we shot that scene together, but I had never seen him without his lizard makeup on. So I had no idea what he looked like. I ended up watching one of his movies that he did in like 1945, and he was a really handsome man. I had no idea. He looked like a lizard to me. If I'd run into him on the street, I would never have recognized him.
I was having the bitchinest dream. Me, oh my, Miss July. She and I sitting on the sofa. Yolanda, baby. Then I jump from this god-awful scream. And there's Alex running to the window. He said,
Hazan, Hazan!
I said, what? He said,
go back to sleep, Lewis.
Then he hurried from the room. It's a Zandazan, the creepy creature in the video game. Remember the name, it's one and the same. Right here in our backyard, better be on your guard. It's a Zandazan, doing stuff that only Zandazans can. Jumping right inside your body, making it do naughty stuff it doesn't want to do.
All right, we're back talking about The Last Starfighter with Outside the Cinema and Are You Serious's Mr. Chris. That's a lot of S's in there. Hopefully,
yeah, that's not fun to say, is it?
So one thing I didn't know when I was researching this was all the media surrounding The Last Starfighter. Like, when I posted the invitation on Facebook, I used a Marvel comic cover, and so many people were like, I had that comic, I read that comic, and it's like, wow, I didn't even know that comic existed.
I had it too.
And then I found like a read-along storybook and stuff. I mean, I guess I was a little too old for this one, I think. I mean, it was 84, so I was probably 12, and, you know, I'm like neck deep in Star Wars and stuff, and I might have been coming down off of my Star Wars high because we had the Ewoks the year before, so I'm kind of souring on the whole idea. And was amazed to see how many different things came out related to this movie and stuff. And of course, video games, you know, just a ton of video games were related to it, on Atari and all these different game consoles. It's kind of a natch.
Yeah, the home systems weren't even anywhere near powerful enough to run anything that looked like what was in the movie. They had, of course, you know, the ability to do whatever they wanted. The funny thing is, now you could run that whole game on your iPod.
Yeah.
Which is absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, they have a little documentary on the DVD of, and I'm sure it's on the Blu-ray, about the making of, and they talk about all the computer power that was needed to create this. But nobody does the one thing that I'm always curious about, where they say, you know, how much CPU it might have been, or how much memory it might have taken, and all that kind of stuff. Because, you know, it's like, I'm sure one frame of Monsters, Inc. was equal to all the work they did on Last Starfighter or something like that. See that progression. But I mean, this thing was, you know, I said it in the intro, it was groundbreaking. And it's funny now to look back at it, and you can kind of snicker and stuff, but for what they did, I mean, they were just doing some amazing things with it. You know, I'm thinking, I guess maybe because I was looking at Castle's filmography and that he did Amazing Stories, you know, I'm thinking about the computer animated opening of Amazing Stories, how, you know, that was astounding and everything, or like the animated sequences in Young Sherlock Holmes and how that was, you know, gosh. But yeah, I mean, to have so much of this movie, and I know they were clever as far as the way they cut around stuff and would interject, you know, live action and everything, but they had quite a few sequences that went on for a while of just all computer generated stuff.
Yeah, and I remember reading, they said that from the Star Car driving to taking off to landing on Rylos, that was the first time that a movie had dared to do anything resembling photorealism on screen to match, which it boggles my mind. I mean, it boggles my mind as much as when I read that when they made Tron, they had to code it, like write the code for it, wait for it to be rendered and come back and hope that it was what they imagined it to be.
Have you ever seen those like errant polygons or whatever when they will render animation and something has screwed up?
Oh,
and,
yeah. Like, some of that stuff's terrifying.
And sometimes it's like still in some of the games that are out there. Like I've seen like animated GIFs or little video clips where it's just like, what the hell is happening
here? Yeah.
It's just blowing up into, you know, 10 times normal size. But yeah, I wish they would have had a little bit of that on that that documentary too. I mean, it was a good doc, but and it was half an hour, so one third of the running time of the film and everything. But it really can't be overestimated or understated just what an impact this movie should have had and you know, on the whole effects thing. And then it's kind of funny because the way it sounds in the doc, it's like, oh yeah, and, you know, it was this really big thing, but nobody really paid attention to it. And it's like, wow, that's so sad.
I have a hard time believing that nobody paid attention to it. I have to imagine that Spielberg and Lucas watched this and said, yeah, that's a good idea. Let me start a company called Pixar. This and Tron have to be historic. For what they did, they are historic films. They pushed special effects into an entirely new generation. I don't think that can be understated. And I know we're talking about The Last Starfighter, but I mean, seriously, it's a revolutionary film, special effects-wise.
And to think that Last Starfighter is, what, almost 30 years old now, just two, you know, 1 year shy of 30 years old, it holds up. And I think, really, the whole thing goes back to what we were talking about earlier, is the storytelling. The storytelling is so strong that if there are maybe a couple little clunky things here and there, I don't care.
No. This is one of those you just sit back and just enjoy it because it's what it is. It's an adventure story, and you can't nitpick fantasy or sci-fi. It's a sci-fi film, but it's definitely fantasy at the same time. So it's like you have to let things go, like the traveling to Rylos and stuff. It's like, well, they don't say hyperspace or light speed or anything like that. They just get there. That's fine. You know, a one-man ship sitting in the middle of the road, whatever, that's fine. You just let it go because otherwise you're just going to drive yourself crazy and not enjoy it.
That's true. I mean, some of the stuff around the asteroid, I think that's really where you get to see, you know, some of the stuff that might have been rendered a little bit more. You know, you think about the same kind of asteroid scene in Empire, you know, 4 years prior, and it's like, yeah, maybe, I don't know. But I guess the thing that I admire, too, is that they could have backed out and said, we're going to do this thing with models, but instead they said, nope, all in, this thing's all CG.
Yeah. The only thing that that was like practical or real were the explosions, which I don't see any computer being able to handle that kind of particle computation at the time, you know, and it adds that little bit more. And the Codan Armada, the yellow ships, not only did they just look powerful just sitting there, but they had like streaks on them. They were dinged up a little bit. There was way more detail in there than first glance would give. So there was a lot going on that just kind of you process subconsciously.
Going back all the way to the opening of our discussion, I don't remember seeing this on the big screen, and I kind of wish I could go back now and see it again on the big screen because, yeah, it seems like they really spent a lot of time, you know, putting some thought into this rather than just like, hey, it's a big game of Pong or something.
Yeah, and the guys, Castle and Cobb, talk on the commentary, and they have such a love for this that after you listen to the commentary, it's hard not to appreciate it more if you like it in the first place, I should say. And the one thing that I really liked is that they acknowledged Spielberg and Lucas, and they said, you know, this was after Star Wars. So every single thing we did, you could connect back to Star Wars. So we didn't make a conscious effort to like go the opposite direction, but they said, you know, you acknowledge that the movie's there, that happened, that he set the, you know, he broke the ground for it and paved the way, but you do your own thing. I don't consider it a ripoff. It's just a different version of the same mythological story.
Yeah. There was even a nice little touch in the screenplay that Lewis hides his Playboys in the screenplay behind a Star Wars poster, which I think was kind of a nice touch.
I like when you're inspired by something, you acknowledge it to a certain degree. I think it just shows respect for everybody around you. I don't know. It made me feel like I like when people I look up to are nice and don't hide the fact that they've, you know, taken things from other places. I know you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah. Well, yeah, we're talking Tarantino in a couple weeks, so we'll definitely be talking more about that.
Because really, I mean, everything, Battle Beyond the Stars and all, Ice Pirates, everything borrowed heavily from Star Wars. But this one just hit on a different level. There's an innocence to it that wasn't there in some of the other ones. It's got that same feeling as like Goonies and Monster Squad. Does that make sense?
I can totally see that, yeah.
Tonality, not necessarily, obviously, the characters are older and we have aliens, but...
Well, it's got that sincerity to it.
Yes, that's the word I was looking for. That's quintessential 80s stuff right there.
Yeah, and I can see if somebody doesn't buy into that level of sincerity, this movie is not going to be for them, but if they can just kind of get with the program and get into it right from the beginning, hey, yeah, this is going to be a good ride for you. The Kodan guys... totally reminded me of, two things. Flash Gordon, those creatures, those guys that are like, you know, monitoring all the things that are going on in Flash Gordon, and they off those, the goggles, and their eyes are all, rah! And also the black hole, because they've got those kind of same creatures.
The monks,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And they're almost like a different race than the commanders.
Right.
But they have the same like skin, but they're shaped, their mouths are shaped different. There's so much just left on the table and not explained, which is great because it leads to good discussions or you think about it a little more. It's like, well, why did they all look different?
Yeah. So it's like, is there a hierarchy of races? And yeah, like where did these guys come from? Why do they speak with a computerized voice kind of thing? A little, you know, like Cylons, yeah. Almost. Are they?
Well, they speak with those voices because it was awesome.
Oh, yeah, that was awesome.
anytime you throw like that sound wave Transformers modulation on a voice, I am sold. You sound like a Cylon. You're my favorite new character.
You know, I read that they were working on a sequel a few years ago. I don't know if they're ever going to do a sequel to Last Starfighter, but I think it was like in 2008, there were rumors that they were going to do it because, you know, Zur does escape at the end, you know, big spoiler alert for people here, but.
Yep. Like the coward he is.
Yeah. I love that though. It's just like, it leaves it open-ended in that regard. I mean, we've won the battle, but we haven't won the war.
Right. Right. And then you have Alex and Maggie to go back to the planet. So, you know, it would be their kid, I imagine, would be the next one of the next brilliant mind. And he'd have to go save a planet that he is, you know, genetically related to that he's never seen. That could create some interesting conflict. But, you know, this is also ripe for a remake. I was just thinking, every time we talk about remakes that should be made on Outside the Cinema or wherever, this is the first movie that springs to mind because with Xbox Live and the PlayStation Network and just Wi-Fi gaming on your phone and everything, you never know who's running this stuff.
Yeah, and why they're doing it.
Yeah, so, you know, you can host your Call of Duty or your Star Wars Battlefront stuff and, You could recruit entire legions from planets if you wanted to. Why can't the Codan Armada start to recruit people the same way?
Yeah.
And then you have like an intergalactic civil war going on. I know that sounds very Star Wars, but it's like, you know, human fighting against human and Ryloth against sorry, I'm getting the names all mixed up.
It feels like there's almost like a link between Last Starfighter, Ender's Game, and Starship Troopers to me.
Yeah, I can definitely see the Starship Troopers, Ender's Game thing. And the Last Starfighter is almost like the Golden Book version of Ender's Game. It's like it's written for kids because Ender's Game is pretty dark. It's not a happy story. But I can definitely see some influence there, especially if they do a sequel and he rises up through the ranks and all that and like commits genocide and atrocities. But again, kids movie.
I guess what you were just talking about, though, with that whole idea of recruiting game players and all this kind of stuff, it reminds me a little bit of the way that Ender does his kind of battle play and all that, and the way that that's teaching, you know, the real soldiers how they're supposed to do it, you know, out in space. It's kind of interesting to see, you know, how those ideas could all be kind of tied together into one big ball.
On a totally strange note, the Robin Williams movie Toys also explored that kids piloting mass destruction weapons. That was a holiday kids movie.
Okay, we're going to take another break and play a preview from next week's show.
Look out! Look out! Look out! Take care. You are being watched. We repeat, take care, for you are now alone with a killer. We warn you, don't let him see the fear in your eyes. For this is what he seeks, and this is why he kills.
Where are you? Where are you?
Look out for Carl Byrne as the Peeping Tom. Fear him, but pity him also.
It's so good.
Watch out for Moira Shearer as the lovely stand-in who innocently dances into danger.
Imagine someone coming towards you who wants to kill you, regardless of consequences.
A madman?
Yes.
Wait! Look!
Anna Massey is the girl who falls victim to the charms of a lonely stranger upstairs.
Switch it off, Mark! Mark, switch it off!
Maxine Audley, as the blind woman who senses the danger that threatens her and her daughter, but is helpless.
Don't be frightened.
Not frightened. Hot. So put that camera away!
There is no future for anyone who tries to befriend him. He invades the privacy of innocent people till the piercing eyes of his camera meet the terrified eyes of his victims. And with a compulsion akin to madness, he shoots the final, fearful scene.
We're going to be back next week to discuss Michael Powell's Peeping Tom, and Rob St. Mary will be back with me after he's completed his mission of mercy. I want to thank this week's special co-host, Mr. Chris. So, Chris, tell me some more about the Are You Serious podcast and tell listeners about Outside the Cinema. I mean, we've had Bill on here before, so hopefully folks have kind of flipped the channel and gone over there. But what's going on there? I mean, you guys had a huge year this in 2012. I mean, doing the Rock and Shock, and you had all the music shows and everything. What's on the plate for 2013?
Rock and Shock this year actually should be huge. It's their 10th anniversary, and we're looking to do some big things, but it's way too early to have any concrete plan. So stay tuned. Right now we are on hiatus because Bill had gender reassignment surgery. No, he had a vertebrae operation. I can't even go through with that joke. That's not funny. And so we pre-recorded a whole bunch of episodes and a bunch of people helped us out. We should be in February. We should be back to live shows Monday at 5, tv.outsidethecinema. And you find us on Facebook. It's just Outside the Cinema. And that's where all the information is. We have another music show coming up, but I don't think we have a topic or a date for it. But we have one coming up soon. It's really helpful, huh? My other show, Are You Serious, is current events, I think is a good way to put it, where nothing is really off limits. And we, my co-host Frank and I, being liberal East Coast elitists, filter the news through that and our experience. Sounds totally fascinating when I talk about it, doesn't it? We put a show out every week. We've been experimenting with streaming live video. So we've been doing those Thursday nights at 10:30. Find us on Facebook. That's where I pretty much talk to everybody and post all the information.
So are you gonna do like a year in review kind of thing for 2012, or just are you doing like the here's what's happening this week instead? I mean, because stuff's happening. Unfortunately, there's always stupid things to be covered.
Yeah. A few weeks ago was not a great time, and I had to learn an awful lot about a lot of things really fast. But the great thing about Are You Serious is that, you know, we're open to everybody's point of view. Frank may call you an idiot, but you know, everybody has a voice with that. We don't do anything special. I mean, we had our 200th episode and we just did the show like normal because I couldn't be bothered to do anything more. All my energy goes into Outside the Cinema. And with Bill having the surgery, our end of year shows are going to be pushed back probably another 3 or 4 weeks from the time this will be released. So stay tuned for that. That should be a lot of fun because I still have a bunch of movies I need to watch to see if they get on my list.
Yeah, if you guys want to pass on me this year, because I feel like I haven't seen anything in 2012. It was not a banner year for me at all. It was mostly just podcasts and stuff.
Yeah, I've seen probably 15 movies like in the theater, so I have no idea what I would put on my list.
Thanks to everyone for listening. Be sure to stop by our website, projection-booth.com, to leave your thoughts or feedback. And be sure to give us a call and leave your thoughts about Quentin Tarantino's Reservoir Dogs for a special upcoming episode. Love them, hate them. Whatever your opinion, we want to hear it, and we'll share it in our mid-February show. Call us over at 734-666-0800. It's free when you call from work.